welcome to the Coaching and Therapy channel. So this channel is quite close to my heart because I train coaches in embodiment. I mean, why? Because if you don't work with the body, you're missing a lot, whether you're a coach, a therapist, facilitator, whatever. That's how you go deep quickly. That's how you do stuff that's sticky. We have to take the body into account. This channel is sponsored by Dylan Newcombe and Uzazu Embodied Intelligence. Dylan is a genius, quite simply put, and I wouldn't say that about many people in this field. I've been studying with Dylan for, God, the first time was probably 10 years ago in the Netherlands. He speaks fluent Dutch, by the way, as well as Korean and a few other languages. What I love about Dylan is his ability to make models of things, looking at how embodiment works. His system, Uzazu, U-Z-A-Z-U, is really all about state shifting. So I think of him as the sort of master of state changing, how we can shift our state, our client's state, and how we can develop ourselves through those different ways of being. So I think for coaches and therapists, it's like easy to learn, practical toolkit. I've used it myself over the years. So if you want a 3-day online training with Dylan, then look at the link below, or you can go to Uzazu, uzazu.org. And even easier, he's got an embodied assessment there you can do as well. We all love doing these little tests about ourselves, but this is an embodied one. So there you go. Welcome to the Coaching and Therapy channel. I'm going to be on this one a lot just because there's lots of cool people on here. Lots of people, I think, you know, well worth a listen. Embodiment in facilitation is so necessary. So from me to you, welcome.
And welcome again, Nikki and Hamish, to this webinar offering you're generously gifting us on attachment theory. So if that's the workshop you were after, you're in the right place. So Nikki, I see from your bio that you're clearly a very busy and inspirational entrepreneur. As co-founder of New Zealand's Spirit Festival, Resolution New Year's Eve Festival, and New Zealand Yoga Day. On top of this, you also offer workshops and the art of loving and sacred sex, which I think speaks to your key passions. I love the focus of your earlier workshop, which was on embodiment in the perinatal period and the importance of positive sexual education for childbirth. Such a valuable subject. Everyone, Nikki has degrees in psychology and childbirth education. And apart from her other passions I mentioned above, she coaches both men and women in all things sexual, sex and relationship related sexual as well, both here, both in New Zealand and internationally. So welcome, Nikki. Hamish Daly from New Zealand. Welcome. In your biography, Hamish, you share the experience of being adopted and growing up amongst the emotional chaos within a family of 5 adopted kids. I have to take a breath on that one, being 1 of 9, but all from the same parents. I've got a tiny window into what that might be like. And you speak about the journey that you took of self-discovery and time in the shadows that this gave you, and the tremendous insight and, dare I say, expertise into the importance of journeying home to the self that this gave you. I really love your expression, everything is relationship, i.e. to body, to nature, to self, to spirit, and to other, and how when one of these relationships is damaged at any point in life, things can take a downward turn. And we're certainly in that sort of period now, aren't we? I also enjoyed on your Facebook site, and we'll give you everyone the links later for both of your wonderful ongoing work, but you have a little video clip there on courageous communication, and that was really valuable. So thanks for being here. And by the by, I share your passion for sailing. So without further ado, we hand it over to these two amazing presenters and look forward to them gifting us information on this incredibly valuable foundational understanding of attachment theory. Thanks again, guys, for showing up.
Thank you so much for the introduction. Janine, that's really epic. Hamish and my work started together. I think it's important to let the listeners know with my podcast, looking at sexuality and relationships and intimacy, and having Hamish on board and us beginning this just 1 hour conversation that has had thousands and thousands of downloads now, and people being really feeling great shifts within. When we brought attachment theory to the light regarding current relationships, because it's a theory that affected us all, or the idea is that we were all affected when we were younger, but the relationship problems that we face now, Hamish and I were speaking about, are not relationship problems, they're childhood problems disguised as relationship problems. So we look forward to reproducing and extending on that chat that we had on the podcast. Hamish, I always love working with you. It's so cool to have you.
It's super good to see you.
Yeah, so first, relationships and how they form our capacity to love is really a really great kind of broad statement. And we think, because this is not just a theoretical discussion, sharing how both of us got into attachment theory, when we shared it, we laughed because it was so opposite and so different in many ways. Yeah, let's begin there. Hamish, how did you get into attachment theory? Why did it interest you?
Great question. And more than why did it interest me, why was it utterly essential to my survival, I think is more the point. There was a time in my life not so long ago where three things happened close together. The first one was that I broke a really important agreement that I had with my daughter's mother. And as a result, my access to my daughter was severely restricted. You know, at the time, I was not okay with that. In the fullness of time, I see why that was like important. So something really precious to me had been not taken away, but access to my daughter was greatly reduced. The other thing that happened was I had a very intense short-term relationship, and that ended, and it impacted me. The ending of it impacted me out of all proportion to like the length and the depth of the connection. Mm-hmm. And a few weeks after that, I found my mother. But what I did was I found my mother's grave, and I was adopted, and I never met her, I never knew her. And I found her grave and found out that she had passed when I was 9 years old. So these three things happened together, and so much was happening inside of me. I was like, what is going on? I don't feel okay. I'm in my 40s and I feel completely out of control. I went to see a therapist, and eventually she said to me, so Hamish, in relationship, do you experience this kind of thing? Like, first of all, do you experience a craving for closeness and touch? And it's almost like you can't get enough. And do you experience like jealousy and your behavior becoming really controlling and you can't understand why? And I was like, yes, and yes. And she said, do you also experience a lot of energy in your body? Like energy that doesn't seem to have anywhere to go and just bounces around. And I was like, I do. And that was the first time that I realized how I experienced a relationship wasn't fundamentally uniquely flawed. Like I wasn't broken. There was knowledge and understanding around what was going on for me. So it was a kind of a pathway out of this really dark place that I was in.
Wow, powerful. My own initiation or interest in attachment theory started when I was probably about 20 years old and was becoming a mother for the first time. And I had a sufficient childhood, a good childhood, but one where I learnt very young that if I was smart and capable and ultra independent, I was safest. And that I knew that having this baby put me at risk of a few things, put her at risk. But if I could just sort of hack the system, find out the perfect path, keep myself safe, keep her safe, we'd be okay. And reflecting now, it's, you know, ultra independence is essentially a trauma response. And my fear of becoming vulnerable or suffering or opening too much had its roots in my childhood. And so leaning into the path of attachment theory felt important not only for myself, but also for my children, I went on to have three, as I knew they were watching how I was relating to myself, my connection to myself, and also to their father. And so coming from different areas, you know, we both realized that often with in relationship or in connection with another, when there is, like you said, in a response that is greater or out of proportion to the depth or the time of that relationship, or if a response or something that's said by a partner to us feels mammoth, it's often because the pain or the that which underlies what's being said is being activated, and it's got very little to do with the current interaction. It stabs a nail right in the point that that we have unresolved trauma within. Mm. Should we do a quick brief history on attachment theory for those who are listening, just because I think it's important to pay homage to those who first conceptualized the idea. And it was based on the work of the psychoanalytic thinkers, Freud inclusive, but really birthed by John Bowlby in the first half of the 20th century, when he visited a whole lot of orphanages and saw their basic needs being met in terms of food and water and sleep, but that's about it, and the catastrophic effects of not meeting small infants' needs. Harry Harlow's work as well is also important to mention here. He had two monkeys, rhesus monkeys he used to work with, and the behavioral theorists at the time were saying, look, you know, Pavlov's dogs, you can teach people sort of like machines, push this button, you get this thing, right? And the little animal learns to push the button. Yeah, we can be programmed. And he kind of really smashed that theory when he had these two monkeys that both produced the same amount of milk with the same bottle, but covered one of the monkeys in like a toweling and put a little monkey face on one of the monkeys and had them both there. And the little baby monkey stopped preferring this milk, even though it was the same as that, preferred to hold on to the fur of the toweling, showing that that connection, that heart was important. And lastly, with Mary Ainsworth, she really built her work on top of that of Bowlby's work. And she created the strange situation experiment, which is just the best name ever, because it sounds like something so fitting for the 70s. In the 70s, whereby she created an experiment that helped to classify and also a classification system for infants in a situation whereby the caregiver was present and then the caregiver would leave, and the behavior of that toddler was witnessed. And that fell into really clearly one of four categories that we'll go into. And depending on whether or not the child protested much, or whether or not the child was easy to calm, or whether or not the child even noticed the disappearance of the mother, was really indicative of what classification they fell into. And then Hazen and Shaver, many years later, actually only really within the last 20 or 30 years, said, hang on, there's stuff here with adults as well. And the AAI, the adult attachment interview, was created. And the work is really exploding now, because we are pretty disconnected at times, aren't we, Hamish? Like, we've all seen our parents in some pretty dysfunctional relationships, and many of us are very, very motivated to create a more harmonious relating life for ourselves and for our children.
Yeah,
anything
absolutely.
You want to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the development of the understanding is really supportive of all of us to see what's happening. It's giving a really comprehensive map of how we move in an embodied way through our connections. And so it's offering all of these points where we can make different choices. So if I want to react in a certain way, when I have an overview of the map, I'd be like, well, a secure attacher would respond in a different way. You know, is that available to me to make a choice that's going to lead me towards that kind of connection with another person, where I'm not reacting, but I'm responding not only to what they're bringing, but to what's being awakened in me.
And for those who never had that model growing up, right, who never saw secure relating, you're not alone. Because, Hamish, what are the statistics? You know, what are the classifications and what are the statistics?
Yes, secure attachment is roughly half of the population. And that's somebody
who's... literally half of us are secure.
Which is fantastic. I think, you know, that's a pretty good starting point to have 50% of the population who are comfortable with intimacy and closeness. They know how to ask for what they want and what they need. They're okay making compromises. And their physiology doesn't freak out when they get close to somebody else. They're like, this is natural and I know how to do this.
Yeah, they don't feel like they are, their sovereignty is at risk, right? They don't feel like they are going to lose themselves in another. They feel comfortable relating and comfortable on their own. What are the other categories and what are their percents?
Roughly a quarter of the population, roughly, is avoidant. So that's the feeling of wanting connection, but then too much connection, too much closeness, I need to move away. Yeah, so really what I enjoy is my freedom and my autonomy. That's super, super important to me.
Yeah,
the second, and the third one is an anxious attachment style, which is my need is for closeness and intimacy. Right? That's my deepest needs. And I can get... I'm prepared to sacrifice my, you know, what you said earlier, my sovereignty or my sense of self in order to get that and keep that connection. And then the disorganized is a few percent, which is a combination of the avoidant and the anxious, right? Which is a super confusing place to be in, and one that I know for myself. I want to get close. And then when I get close, I really need to like bounce out of the connection. And then when I'm out, I start missing the connection. So I'm in this really, you know, it can be very intense in and out, push and pull kind of setup.
Yeah. And I mean, this is all, according to Bowlby, according to the people we spoke to, this is directly in relation to the relationship that we had with our primary caregiver from the age of really 0 to 2, but 0 to 7, developmental psychologists are feeling. So it's, yeah, typically the mother, and it's whether or not our needs were met. And our needs can never be met 100%, as any parents will feel me on. Our needs can never be met 100% of the time, and to become securely attached, have that classification, you don't need 100%. But there needs to be a consistency of response, which is starkly absent from alcoholic parents, from parents often with mental illness, from parents who have been neglectful, physically abusive or sexually abusive, but neglect tops the chart there as being one of the most grave. Having the most grave effect on the attachment pattern. And if you're one of many, many children, if you had an early adoption, if your parents struggled deeply for finances and work, if your parents had their own traumas that they were processing and a needy baby alerted in them some resistance, you know, there are many confounding factors that can create insecurity. I think that's why we see 50% of the population. And the anxious and the avoidant that we talk about, they are basically strategies that the infant develops in order to simply exist. And they are ones that are so embedded and so imprinted that they come out, they can just lay dormant for many years, and then in the right situation with the relationship one really cares about, or when one really begins to lean in, these old patterns or these old feelings arise and put kind of like a barrier or a coating on the person that really has no place in the current relationship, yet acts as a preventative armor for the pain that the child back in the day had to endure.
Yeah, totally. And I think like we're kind of right on top of the important piece here, that the child's need for safety and love wasn't met in a way that was nourishing and nurturing. Mm-hmm. And you know, the importance of this understanding and the work that we can do for ourselves is we can create a space within a connection where that sweetness and that tenderness becomes available to us. What did you say at the end there? Sorry, Nikki, I dropped that last piece. There was something I wanted to add on to that. Do you?
No, the armor. I spoke to sort of like we wear it like an armor.
Yeah, and that's so like an avoidant attacher will wear an armor, and an anxious attachment person will, the opposite, will be like everything will be coming out, everything, all of the fire, all of the heat, all of the desperation and the hunger, and we do the opposite. You know, we're trying to get through your armor and have you pay attention to us and turn and look.
I love working with you, because so often the example I give is so typical of leaning towards the avoidant attacher. So I would say, we wear it like an armor. And he's like, we give it with everything we have. And at this, I'm like, ugh. And he's like, ugh. Yeah. And we personify that connection. And I think we both use our body when we're explaining this so much, like I feel really driven to, because it essentially is an embodiment piece. These are things that have landed within ourselves. They're not mental conscious processes. They reside deep within. And it requires one, like you said, admission or sort of acknowledgement of the fact that we have a choice point, that we can bring it up out of the darkness, out of the subconscious, and bring it into a space where we can decide what to do with it now. If we didn't have our needs met as we wanted to, as 50% of us didn't, we're not right off when it comes to relationship. Is that right?
Yeah, totally. Totally. And if people are listening and they're resonating with either like your experience or my experience, chances are they've been through this cycle in a dysfunctional way at least once. Should we go into that now? Is now the time to have a look at that?
Yeah, definitely. Stories that they tell themselves, right? What are some of the stories or the, you know, what are they protecting? What are their key fears here? And drop in the comments, guys, if this is you, do you find yourself wanting more from your partner almost insatiably? Or do you find when your partner acts that way to you that you want to sort of push away? Drop a yes in the comments. I think, don't be afraid of owning it. That's what Hamish said. That's the first point. That's the first admission of the choice point. What are anxious people tell us, Hamish? What are they protecting? What is their greatest fear? What is their story?
Yeah, the deep fear of somebody who's in an anxious attachment pattern. It's worth noting we can shift between the two. Depending on the connection we're in, we can shift between any of the four attachment styles. Mm. But the deep fear in the anxious attachment setup is rejection and abandonment. And deeper than, and the, like the deepest deep need, or the deepest deep fear rather, is the fear that I'm not worthy of love. And on the other side, for the avoidant person, or the person who's running the avoidant attachment setup, the deepest fear is either that they're going to lose their autonomy or they're going to get overwhelmed and disintegrated by the connection or within the relationship.
And we often, with avoidance, separate that again into two subcultures, subsettings. Fearful avoidance, yeah, or dismissive avoidance. And that's quite great because that's an interesting one to oscillate between. You get your own version of that push and pull that he was speaking about, but in a very avoidant sense. And I think that often society can really applaud the avoidant, because avoidant tendencies, ultra independence, striving for external gratification, but no one come too close. They're really the super mum, all of this stuff. We get applauded for the very thing that keeps us out of our heart, out of our bodies, and somewhat, I would say, at a distance, right, to love, and therefore not that fulfillment. And so there's sort of complications within society as well.
Yeah, you're exactly right with that. You know, it's an admirable trait because we value independence and self-reliance, and you know, avoidance. So people with an avoidant attachment style tend to have that in spades. And my sense is that like the deep fear of the avoidant is that they're not going to be loved the way they want to be loved.
The hoop is so small. Yeah. I found myself in the past that the deep belief is that it's just not possible to love me or to meet me as I desire to be. And to prove that, I will make the hoop that you must jump through to meet my needs smaller, and it will also move. So just as you try to reach it, it jumps out the way. And then I am right that no one can actually love me. So it's a sad place to be, and it's a difficult place to be. And there are traps within the relationship dynamic, aren't there, Hamish? And this is where your work has been really interesting. Hamish has been focusing a bit, you know, amongst other things, on why, looking at things like, why do the anxious and avoidant, why is this such a draw?
There is undeniable that there's often a lot of chemistry between an anxious and an avoidant attachment.
Here's how
style.
To spot if you're in one now. Here's how to spot if you're in one.
Yeah, a lot of chemistry, and possibly a lot of stories running. This could be the one. Oh my God, this person is so amazing. Wow, I can't believe that they're connecting with me. And that's the beginning of the trap or the cycle that has like four distinct parts. And the first part is that incredible connection and chemistry and a lot of hope that, you know, maybe this relationship is going to be different. And the second step in the cycle is the first moment of disconnect. So the anxious, the avoidant person might just need to take a little bit of space. The anxious person, one of their superpowers, or our ultimate superpower, is we're highly sensitive to the emotional states of others. So if we feel our partner need to take some time, we might interpret that or misinterpret that as them losing interest or the relationship being in trouble. And from that place, we start to activate our attachment system. I need them back. I need to do something to ensure that they're going to pay attention to me and they're not leaving. And if it gets resolved there, like the relationship is pretty solid. But when we're in this unconscious place and I'm just reacting, that second stage of a little bit of disconnect is going to pretty quickly move into conflict. And as an anxious attacher, my system is going to be super activated, a lot of thoughts, and what I was saying before about this, like reaching out, trying to grab you back and keep you close. I'll be spending a lot of time thinking about you and what you're doing and why haven't you called me or texted me back. I'll text you and text you and text you. I'll start trying to make agreements with you about how you spend your time and who you spend it with. The energy will be an energy of both pleading and demand. right, on the anxious attaches side. And as my system activates, the avoidant attacher is going, what the, like, and their system cools down and de-escalates. And they just slowly or very quickly, whether it's energetically disconnecting, emotionally or physically out, that's the reactive pattern. So that's the third stage. And the fourth stage, either the relationship will end and the anxious person takes ages to find equilibrium. The avoidant person tends to return to equilibrium quite quickly and they're able to move on. If the relationship doesn't end and the people continue to are able to find a way through, some kind of compromise will be made and the anxious attacher will lose power in relationship to the avoidant. Because the anxious attacher will try and fit themselves into whatever shape they think this person wants. Right? I'm the person with the issues. I'm the person with that needs to do the work. I'm the person that needs to change. I'm pretty good as I am. And so the power shifts. And if we jump on the cycle again, it's just going to entrench and get more extreme. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, this sounds, yeah, drop a comment, a note in the comments if that's familiar to you, you know, in a form. I think right now what I think is I see the little child. I see the little child who perhaps never quite got the attention or the love or the consistency of nurturance that they so desired. And just totally unaware, they just project it onto another because this is like a key human need that evolutionary-wise, like now in our modern society, the baby doesn't know that we're just busy, that we don't mean it personally. Like, no. In order to grow up with this healthy mental health, it's imperative. And from the avoidance side, it's like perhaps they were given a bit and then not. And then the parent was there and then not. And so when they showed up open and vulnerable and here, sometimes they were really hurt. And sometimes it was okay. And this is typical of families where alcohol had a big role or where trauma played a big part. Or inconsistency was the key. And so they learned that if they place themselves just at a foot distance, that they're able to regulate themselves and that they're safer. When in fact, they know that there will keep them at a foot's distance from life's pleasures as a whole, from joy, from deepening into everything. So I feel that seeing the little child, and I know in my current relationship, a lot of this plays out. And it didn't play out in my last relationship. That was different. So it's important to say now that each relationship, you know, no matter how toxic it feels, if you choose to sit in it, any toxic relationship really is actually like an illuminating relationship. And that's what Christopher Wallace says. That it's an illuminating relationship if you choose. Mm-hmm. I think what we do now, Hamish, is go where to from here and just mention those things that me and you and I were mentioning regarding like stuff people can do. And then we hit the comments because I see heaps of questions. People, you know, pop your questions either in the Q&A or in the chat because we really want to get to them. But before we do this, yeah, where to from here, Hamish? Like, what can people do? They're absolutely stuffed in the relationship. They want some help.
Yeah, so there are two pathways that I recommend in terms of finding a way through or through to secure relating. And the first one is inner child work. So that's meeting, not thinking about, but meeting energetically, meeting emotionally, really meeting the inner child and seeing what they need most. And not what they need most in relationship, but what they need most to grow into a fine woman or a fine man. And then from that place, not only providing that as adults, so we become the adult to our own inner child, we become the parent to our own inner child. And often it's a need for a nurture, a need for love, and a need for play and adventure. So the play and adventure often gets overlooked. And we're providing opportunities for the little kid in us to be joyous and free. And an idea like providing love to my inner child is a bit broad and amorphous, a bit hard to get a grasp on. What that looks like is learning what's good for me and what's not good for me, right? What triggers me and what doesn't trigger me, what nurtures me and what damages me. And then the adult self taking over and saying no to the people and the situations that aren't good for me. I really need to step up and protect that little boy that still lives inside of me by being able to name and enforce my boundaries. And at the same time, I need to learn what's good for me and let that in. Learn to let that in.
And from a therapeutic perspective, what Hamish is speaking about is affect regulation. And that was what was missing from everyone who can classify at any point or can identify at any point in their lives as having an insecure attachment style or tendency. And affect regulation is emotional regulation. And it's something that we should, or that our systems expected us to receive from our primary caregiver. That dyadic relationship that formed the blueprint for how we relate to every single person. It's Hamish crying and me as his mother hearing his cries and then providing a solution for him to feel happy again, which acknowledges, nurtures, and encourages him back to stasis, right? Rather than to sort of staying in his pain. And when we witness that in the adults around us, and when someone's there to pick us up when we fall and to hear us when we're irrational and to, right? We grow up as adults that don't project that need onto our partners. We grow up to be women who can hold that without needing the partner to be the father figure or to be the mother figure to sort of guide us in our wild. Or we grow up to be the man who can process and can feel and can hold his vulnerability without feeling the rage of the blockage of that. And the tsunami of like pain that's never been allowed to be felt because it wasn't man enough when he was three. And there's just so much there in affect regulation, so much gold. And as you say, inner child work, becoming the parent of your own inner child. Because if you don't, that inner child is reaching up and grabbing the steering wheel of your life. And like a little 2 or 3 or 4 year old, driving your existence, and no one wants a toddler or preschooler in the front seat of a car. And if you're feeling like, God, sometimes I'm just subconsciously driven to do things or say things I don't want to, you need a conversation with your inner child because it's running the show. And yeah. And right, would you say like bringing it on board and being that parent, giving it what you never got?
Yeah. And as much as I need to have a conversation with my little child, there's a little boy inside of me screaming to be acknowledged. Hey. And the longer I ignored him, the more pain he was in, and the louder and louder and louder and louder he got, until eventually I could no longer ignore him. And I was fortunate to, you know, it wasn't like I was just like, hey, I know how to do that. I got supported into meeting that part of myself. So that's kind of the first pathway. And the second pathway to healing this is similar. And it's for both anxious and avoidant attachers, learning to represent ourselves fully. Right? What I want, this is what I want, and this is what I need. And for an anxious attacher, we're going to have to work through a lot of shame. I shouldn't be this needy. I shouldn't be this way. I should be different. So we need to get underneath that, through that layer, and become our own representative.
I think this for avoidance, Yeah, sorry. I think for avoidance, it's like, I can be needy. I can be vulnerable. I don't need to be this strong or this constantly this brave. It's like they're finding their balance, right? The opposite almost.
Yeah, and I think like for an avoidant attacher, again, communicating their needs, I really want to be close and I need my own space.
Mm.
I love being with you and I love being on my own. So how do we negotiate that transition from togetherness to alone? How do we negotiate and communicate about what we, you know, and is there a way to meet, like to meet?
Yeah.
And really learning to listen to other people when they tell us and show us with their actions who they are. So an anxious attacher is going to tell a lot of stories and they're not going to witness the truth of the other person. They're going to believe the story more than they believe the reality. So puncturing that fantasy is really useful so that I can see the person who I'm with and recognize, you know what, I don't think they are able to meet me where I'm at.
Mm. Yeah, simple. not being seduced by the inner need, not letting that cloud what's truly in front of us. And beginning really clear on like, man, I always call in men who are unavailable. What does this highlight if I go back to my childhood? What was dad like? What was mum like? Am I trying to prove something here? Because it's not his job to. There's something that I need to tune in. Am I putting myself through this pain because I believe it's integral to my identity? I am unworthy. There's so much to explore. Hamish, should we have a look at some of the Q&As?
Sure. Yeah, let's.
Okay. Hamish, with avoidance, I don't understand that question. Cody, let's pop down to another one you asked. In a relationship between one with anxious attachment and the other with an avoidant attachment, is it common for emotional abuse or gaslighting more from the avoidant? And does this happen because the anxious is more sensitive? Good question.
The gaslighting definitely happens. And, you know, that's the unconscious, that's the reaction. When I'm in this, when I'm connected with somebody and my avoidant tendencies are online, the intimacy and closeness, at a certain point, I just need to pop out. It's just too much. And if I'm unconscious of it, I just feel this thing in my body, I'll tell myself heaps of stories about that other person to make it okay. And I can't handle what's happening in my body. I don't know what's going on. I don't know how, but this closeness is too much. So I'm going to pop out. And I haven't developed the capacity to communicate honestly about what's going on for me. So what I'll be thinking is I'll be telling myself lots of stories about the other person. Of course, I'm not going to communicate that to them. So gaslighting, emotional abuse, like I'm not sure exactly what they mean by that, but jealousy and controlling behavior is going to come from the anxious attacher because they feel so unsafe.
I think, you know, when they say here, like, is it more common from the avoidant, emotional abuse and gaslighting? It's certainly an effective technique to maintain the power differential. Right. And that is, you know, really honest often because they don't need to be close anyway. They can throw that and maintain it because it reinforces the fact that distance is beneficial and, you know, not their true belief, but one they've learned to be. So I would say, and I've seen it and you can see it on things like different power plays with relationships on screen, even often the gaslighting can be used as a power play, and the anxious one is more sensitive, but the anxious one, like Hamish said, is more malleable. So there is, like, because they want to fit into anything that you can fit, and that just kind of annoys the avoidant even more at times, because what they want is for them to really be big enough and strong enough to deep down meet them and let them know that they are worthy rather than play into exactly the thing that they're trying to force them into. Peggy, can you speak more about why we might have different styles in different relationships? In my last relationship, I thought I was secure avoidant, but now I'm single and dating, I actually find myself really anxious. You want to speak to that, Hamish, or do you want me to?
Yeah, I'm not sure if this will answer the question exactly. I'll have a shot through this, through the idea of threat and threat response. So what was the first part of that question? Why do we shift between?
Yeah, why do we shift between? And once she was one, but now she's anxious. It's got something, I would say, to do with fear of being alone, fear of self, perhaps anxious avoidance. That runs the base of her, that's potentially your base identity or your foundational attachment style. But in a relationship up with another, a secondary, because it's not an exact science as well. And I think that when we're alone, we get a really, really clear indication of our foundational attachment, of our most predominant attachment style. And then when we're with another, the dynamic brings about new challenges, pushes different buttons. But if as a single woman, you're always just looking for someone, that says a lot about how you just feel about self. Or if when you're single, you just don't want anyone and you find yourself really isolating. That would be my answer to that. But we have many more questions. Can one oscillate between anxious and avoidant? And how do we heal oscillating between anxious and avoidant?
Yeah, great, great question. Avoidants are fantastic at staying in long-term relationships that aren't deeply satisfying. Like this is a superpower, and it's possible to. I've stayed in long relationships, and I've been in the avoidant attachment position. And my short-term, super painful relationships have been when I've been in the anxious role and the woman has been in the avoidant role. And the emotionally unavailable woman turned me on. And that's a direct reflection of what I didn't get from my mother, because what could be more avoidant than a completely absent mother? Right, adopted at birth, never touched, I never knew her. So there was some part of me that was wanting to attract the avoidant woman, emotionally unavailable person, woman, and have her want me so much that she would change. Mm. Right, that was the kind of the spiritual, the mythical, deep psychological quest. And when I saw it for what it was and recognized that I was never going to be able to change somebody, right? I don't have the power to change another person who doesn't want to change. Mm-hmm. When that really landed in my being, then avoidant woman dropped off my radar. Was no longer attracted to or curious, sexually or romantically curious about them. I was just a hard no. No.
Wow.
So it's Yeah, you go.
No. That is super interesting, because looking through some of the other questions, people say that. And what I want to say to a lot of the questions that say oscillation between anxious avoidant or will I always be sort of stuck between these? Hamish just said then, it is typical for these to become entrenched and to stay after pain, but that your sign of growth, a sign of addressing what needs filling, a sign of addressing what was missing so drastically perhaps at birth or around those early developmental years, or perhaps where you were majorly hurt. People have mentioned in the comments here, the questions, after immense betrayal or infidelity, pain and unhealthy patterns of relating can happen as an adult when we are hurt as well. The attachment theory speaks about the importance of those first early years is a great indicator. But of course, we know the brain is malleable. We know there's this plasticity to our development, the potential for growth and the potential for hurt. So as Hamish said, when you do the work, when you claim radical self-responsibility for your upbringing, for your pain that's happened in your life, infidelity, trauma, cheating, whatever it is, and when you are prepared to become the parent to that inner hurt place and really, really own all the weird ways, the unhealthy ways that you're acting, that's when you start to notice shifts. Well, I'm not interested in the unavailable guy anymore. Or like you said, I don't desire the emotionally unavailable woman to fill that need of mine. If it says here, does an anxious person shift avoidant behavior? When you're in relationship with someone that's making a conscious effort to bring in more security and to identify more as a secure person, they're going to be taking a lot of self-responsibility. And it's really hard to play your games of gaslighting, emotional abuse, distancing, clinging, enmeshment with someone who's taking radical self-responsibility for what they're doing. Because what they're going to do is go, I'm now, Hamish, I'm going to exit this dynamic. We're dropping into that again. I'm bringing it to consciousness and I'm stepping out. And so, yes, it does. An anxious person shifting naturally will shift the avoidant behavior, but only to the degree that the other is willing to look at the role that they're playing as well. You can be a catalyst. You can exit stuff that, and before you got in an enmeshed circle, but ultimately the relationship is 50% one and 50% another. So we're doing this work with a partner, getting really clear, both of you looking into it, both of you claiming, oh my God, this is who I am, doing the online quiz, looking into who you are, reading the books, is a great way for both of you to really clear the clutter, the baggage that you bring in from your past and you dump in between the two of you so you can barely see each other anymore. Shall we pop to the chat here in the last few minutes? We just got a time. Any more questions? Oh, there's so many questions here. How does an anxious person, Hamish, start to evolve into a more secure style? What is the primary thing that they can do to begin?
Learn not to blame the other person and get curious about what it is in me that is attracted to this kind of person, right? The other person is being who they are. And what in me is attracted to that kind of person?
Wow. Radical curious, self-responsibility.
Free from blame.
Yeah, absolutely. What we're getting also a question saying, how do avoidant attachment styles manifest when it comes to children? I'm having deep fears around a complete loss of freedom, autonomy, my sense of self when I explore the idea of having children. And we've also just been given the time's up call. So what I want to say to that is check out both Hamish and my work. We're going to pop a, you can see there my website, nikkiar.com, and I'm sure Janine will close it as well. But both Hamish and I deeply do this work deeply in slightly different spheres, and we'd just love to hear from you. I'll pass it on to you now, Janine.
Great. Thanks, Nikki and Hamish. I wish we were an audience, would give a round of applause. Thank you so much. And thanks to all the participants for contributing so much. It's really valuable when you're expressing your need for Hamish and Nikki to speak to that. And I really love that you both spoke to that we can change our attachment styles through addressing what was needed. And I think part of that is being compassionate with ourselves as we go along that journey, but radical responsibility Agreed, Hamish, a really key point. So yes, so the so you can go after this talk to the embodiment chat group, coffee break room. You can also send questions, so you'll find all the links to both Nikki and Hamish's websites, their ongoing workshops. They both work with individuals and I'm sure are doing that online now. But also too, if you've only been able to digest this and a little bit of all the webinars that are on offer at this extraordinary conference, please consider a way of supporting the conference and supporting the fact that so many people worldwide who might not normally have ever been able to have exposure to this material, which we hope all of this information adds to that 50%, Hamish, that, you know, we get secure attachment nudging towards more 60, 75%. Hoorah, we'll have, you know, and changing leaders and so forth that have got more secure attachments will make a really good difference to the planet. So please, if you're in a position to support the conference and all the extraordinary work that's happened, by going to the link on the embodiment, and you can, at a very reasonable cost, and there's a super mega deal until the 25th of October, I think, to be able to purchase lifetime access to all the workshops. So you can come back and revisit all this valuable information at your leisure, because it's a monumental amount. But I love this work in attachment. You guys really expressed it beautifully and how it shows up in relationships. It's certainly pivotal in, has been in my life and in my work. So thank you so much for that and honouring those that gifted us the insights from the very beginning. Now, just our final way of completion, apart from thanking you both for your generous offering and thanking you all for participating and offering your questions, we have a little ritual to complete, and that is to ask each of you if you could say in one sentence or less what your top tip, sort of takeaway or giveaway to participants would be around attachment theory. You can kind of gave it. Given us so many, but you could even, you know, it could be one of those essence, one of those things that you already shared. You've shared so much.
Yeah. Discover your unique essence and believe in it.
Beautiful.
Work to develop and support that.
Beautiful.
My top tip would be to not be afraid of getting really honest with yourself and what you need. Your needs matter. Yeah, they're important. Even if they weren't when you were a little baby.
Beautiful. Exactly. Needs matter. And our unmet needs show up symptomatically in our life if we don't listen to them, and they get louder and louder and louder. So it's certainly efficient.
Yes.
It's certainly efficient to do that and take care of that. Okay, thank you once again, guys.